night in question, the rain was particularly violent. It came down like handfuls of nails, flung hard and fast by a seriously riled sky god.
Hello and welcome to this short fiction masterclass brought to you by Threshold's International Short Story Forum in collaboration with the Charleston Trust. My name is Jack Catania, and today I'm going to be talking to the Irish writer Kevin Barry about his short story collection, Dark Lies the Island, as well as his novel Beaklebone, which won the Goldsmiths Prize in 2015. Kevin has also been awarded the Sunday Times Short Story Prize, the Rooney Prize for Irish Literature, the Impact Dublin Literary Award, the Authors Club Best First Novel Award, and the Edgehill University Short Story Prize. Today we will be discussing The Gift of Finding Stories, the relationship of memory to the imagination, and the musicality of the short story form. Kevin, welcome and thank you for talking to us today. As we're at Small Wonder Short Story Festival, we're going to be talking about your short fiction, in particular the stories from your most recent anthology, Dark Lies the Island. But I'm also going to draw on your most recent novel, Beaklebone, which is a visionary imagining of a journey made by John Lennon to the island he owned in Kew Bay, Lennon's island.
It was strange, that strange little fact of John Lennon owning an island off the west coast of County Mayo had been in my head and surfacing in my work in lots of different ways, actually, for a few years. I tried lots of ways to get rid of it. And in the title story, Dark Lies the Island, the island referred to is actually John's.
It's John's.
And I thought putting it in a short story would get it out of my head.
Yeah.
And little did I know that soon enough I would start writing a novel about it.
And in fact, the west coast of Ireland comes through in many of the stories in this anthology, and it's the setting for Fjord of Killarney as well. Mm. So if you wouldn't mind reading the opening of that.
I will. I'll read from just the first page or so of the story, Fjord of Killarney. So I bought an old hotel on the Fjord of Killarney. It was set hard by the harbour wall, with Moyle Rae Mountain across the water and disgracefully grey skies above. It rained 287 days of the year, and the locals were given to magnificent mood swings. The night in question, the rain was particularly violent. It came down like handfuls of nails, flung hard and fast by a seriously riled sky god. I was, at this point, 8 months in the place, and about convinced it would be the death of me. "It's end of the fucking world stuff out there," I said. The chorus of locals in the hotel's lounge bar, as always, ignored me. I was a fretful blowin' by their mark, and simply not cut out for tough, gnarly, West of Ireland living. They were listening instead to John Murphy, our alcoholic funeral director. "I'd bury anything that fucking moves," he said. "Bastards, suicides, tinkers," he said. "I couldn't give a fucking monkeys," he said. Moyle Rae is the most depressing mountain you've ever seen, by the way, and its gaunt, looming shape filled almost every view from the Water's Edge Hotel, the lounge bars included. The locals drank mostly Bushmills whiskey and Guinness Stout, and they drank them to great excess. I wiped their slops from the counter with a bar cloth I had come to hate with a passion that verged on the insane. I said, "But seriously, that's one motherfucker of a high tide, no?" Barely the toss of a glance I received, the bar talk had shifted to roads, mileage, general directions. They made a geography of the country by the naming of pubs. "Do you know Madigan's and Maynooth?" "I do, of course." "You take a left there." "I have you now." The hotel had 23 bedrooms and listed westward. Set a can of peas on the floor of just about any bedroom and it would roll slowly in the direction of the gibbering Atlantic. The estate agent had gussied up the history of the place in the brochure. Traditional couching in, original beams, visited by Thackeray, heritage bleeding out the wazoo, and I had leapt at it. I was the last of the hopeless romantics.
Thank you. So in Beaklebone, you talked about springing a story from its places.
Hmm.
being guided by the feelings trapped within those places and also the feelings trapped within your characters, a kind of psychogeography of place.
Mm.
So could you tell us a little bit more about how the interaction between character and place works when you're writing a story like this?
Okay, well, actually sometimes as a story writer you get a gift, you get an absolute present. And I was out around the Fjord of Killary on a hysterically wet bank holiday Monday evening after cycling about 60 kilometres in rain and wind. And I was just sitting in this hotel lounge bar. I was looking out the window and the locals at the bar were talking exclusively about roads, mileage and general directions. I looked out the window and the water seemed to be rising. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you get a short story in a kind of a fell swoop. And I just thought, what if it kept on coming? What if it didn't stop rising?
So I
immediately knew then that I had an apocalyptic story.
Yes.
That this was an end of the world story. And I also had a nice perspective because it would be the end of the world as perceived from a little hotel bar on the Fjord of Killary, and how would they react?
Yes.
And what would they do? And it just turns out really that they start drinking a little bit quicker.
Yes. So
that's all that kind of happens in the story. But no, it's
but there's a revelation for your character, your main character in the story.
Yeah, and actually
kind of it's a release for him, isn't it?
Yeah, actually, right. And even in that first page or so there, you can hear he's a poet. We mightn't have discovered quite yet, but the way he describes his locals and the local people, he's quite superior.
Yes.
You know? And he kind of portrays them almost as these kind of savages, but it becomes apparent, I think, as the story goes on, that they're at least kind of comfortable in their own skins, and he's not.
And he isn't.
At all. And it's funny, sometimes in a story you only really discover what it's about after the fact. And I remember reading that story at an event in Ireland a year or two after I had written it, and I just thought, actually, it's a very loud story on the surface. You know, there's lots of characters, there's lots of talk, there's the end of the world happening, there's an apocalyptic flood, nature is out of whack in the Shakespearean sense, but really it's a very simple story and a quiet story about aging and just about getting to that kind of mark at around 40 or so where the poet character has come to. That's what it's about. And then I actually dated it in my head. I asked myself, when did I write it exactly? And it was May 2009, and I hit 40 myself in June 2009, so it was obviously on my mind. But it's very simply about coming to an acceptance of the aging process at that point, when kind of youth has definitively flown, really, at that point. You know?
And I think that's the end of the story.
It is.
It's a kind of a letting go.
He has a kind of
lets go, words come back. He's blocked, isn't he? Language
I think the word used is acceptance or something at the end of the story. At some point, we all realise that you just have to kind of go with it.
But at the same time, he reaches for a notebook and he begins again.
He does, So it's kind of, even though the world is ending hysterically, it's a kind of a vaguely hopeful note that we go out on.
It is. If they survive the flood, which we hope they will. But it's also about language, because there's a point where he was kind of writing down the sorts of things that the locals said in his notebook, and then he got sick of them and he said they're very sentimental, they're mawkish.
Yeah.
But actually he says that he's the hopeless romantic, so there's a kind of projection going on in that character.
There's an interesting thing about when, as an Irish writer, you do speech on the page, especially with West of Ireland speech, there's always a tendency that you can over-egg it a bit, because it can be so rich and ripe. But at the same time, I always think, you know, people who come from the West of Ireland do actually sound like they come from West of Ireland. I think it's very similar, actually, to something that story writers from the American South have to deal with as well.
Yes.
The speech can be so rich and expressive and can seem almost over the top that you almost have to kind of take it down a level or two sometimes on the page, or it can seem too much or too ripe. But it's important to be kind of true to it as well.
So when you've got a first person narrator, do you distinguish between what you're putting into the dialogue and how you're doing the internal voice?
Yeah, well, it's really weird for me. If I think back about different short stories, I couldn't tell you which ones are first person or third person or anything. I can never really remember, and it always sort of surprises me, some stories, when I find out that they are actually first person or something. I just go with what feels natural when the idea is there, and I tend to be more worried at the time about timing in the story and about how the events unfolded. Because, you know, it's such a difficult form in terms of the space that you have.
It is.
Like, you have so little room to play with. You have to get the reader inside half a page, really.
Mm.
You have to convince them of a world inside half a page, which is very hard. And it's the reason why so many short stories go wrong on you as a writer. And go wrong for all story writers, I think. Because you have no room for manoeuvre. And I try lots of stories that don't work out.
You do.
The important thing is to keep trying them.
Mm. Do you tend to stay with a story that's not working, or do you...
I have a feeling that I should try and finish everything that passes across my desk to some level.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of almost a superstition I have that even if you finish the kind of bad stories, you kind of earn the good stories that might come along from time to time as well. And the old truism, I guess, that you learn so much from the failures and the ones that fall off the table and break their necks on the floor.
Fail again, fail better, as Beckett said.
Apparently they're using that now as a kind of a business
phrase, okay.
Well, which is horrendous. He would be horrified, God bless him. I've been reading the Beckett letters, the collected Beckett letters, and they're so heartening, really, because no matter how awful you're feeling, Mr. Beckett is feeling worse. We guarantee.
Yes, great. So, to me, it seemed that the Fjordur Kaleri had a classic short story arc. Things, you know, things got worse. They reached a kind of climax or crisis point, and then there was some kind of resolution at the end. Do the shapes form as you write? Do you ever begin with a shape of a story?
I don't think so, no. And I'm sure there are arcs and all that kind of thing in the stories and places, but I can't say they're completely accidental.
No.
But that, I think what gives you maybe elegant shapes and so forth in a story is if you get that kind of timing.
Yes.
Right, and decide, like, the order of the events. I go at it really pretty blindly, you know? What I will tend to have is a very kind of insistent idea for an opening.
Yes.
Of a story, and I will tend to have a fairly good idea of where I think it should end and where it's going to, but I don't want there to be anything in the middle of that I know about, really.
Mm.
And
it's discovery
line by line, and I do think it's kind of a musical form inherently, the short story, in some ways, and that every story has a kind of a melody or a tune that's inherent to it, and you're just trying to follow it along sentence by sentence and line by line. And I remember as a very young and callow emerging writer reading an interview with Don DeLillo, where he said he was, and it seemed heroic to me at the time, he said he was completely prepared to change the meaning of a sentence for the sake of its sound. All he was really interested in was the sound and the rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
And that really struck home on me. I thought that's exactly how I feel about it. And you all must leave the sound then determine the story in some kind of way. But I don't know, the stories are very difficult to talk about in some ways, because they're it's a very mysterious form.
Mm.
And almost the more you do it and the closer you get into it, the less you know.
It feels like
it's and it's very hard, those stories that go wrong and that fall off the desk, it's very hard to read back over it and find the sentence where it went wrong and how it broke down, you know. But what you do know very, very clearly as well is when a story is working.
Yes.
And when it's there's kind of a noiseless kind of click or something that happens, you know. And with my favourite stories and my best stories, I suppose definitely Fjordur Kaleri is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember very much about the writing process, only that it was quick.
Yes.
I'd say 4 or 5 days.
Uh-huh.
And that just everything seemed to, and I think because the inspiration for it was very clean, as in I saw the scene presented with the actual characters, really.
Yes.
In a pub and all of that. But I think you get very few gifts, really, like that in story writing. Very often I'm working at them, not continuously for years, but I'll be coming and going a lot and looking back at something, you know.
And I wanted to talk about memory as part of the process, because your characters are often haunted by memory. When I read the reviews of Beaglebone, it really struck me that people started talking about their own lives.
Hmm.
We go into John Lennon, your John Lennon character's consciousness, but we're also interdispersing that with cultural memory.
Mm.
And I noticed that the critics began to riff on their own memories and how that kind of intersected with the novel and the stories, and began to talk about themselves rather than your writing.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Actually, I think you're right, and I hadn't particularly noticed it myself, but no, I think that's true. God, Beetlebone is even more difficult to talk about than the stories. Really, it kind of felt like a constant crisis on the desk for the time it took, because it was very hard, you know, because I was giving myself such a cross for my back at the start by taking such an iconic figure.
Yeah, taking an iconic figure.
Yeah, because
taking real history.
Yeah, and because
reimagining.
Because so many readers are going to come to that book with an idea before they go to page one of what he should sound like, and might be happy if he doesn't sound like what they think. So it was real.
And you did work on that, didn't you? You listened to interviews.
Oh, I did. Yeah. And there was we talked about first person and third person. I did them all. I threw the kitchen sink at it.
Mm.
It's in the past tense and the present tense and the future. Mm. Everything. It's just
because I had to go back to it to remind myself it was actually written in the third person, because it's so lucid and it's such free
speech
that I get the sense of a first person moving through it.
Well, yeah, and very perceptively, because it was until quite a late stage it was in first person, and I think maybe from the last just two drafts of it I changed it to third, I could kind of heard the click when I did that. You know, it felt like it was kind of coming together then. So it's a third that feels very close in, I think. All right,
close to the first.
Yeah.
In fact, the quote at the start of the book is the most elusive island of all, the first person singular.
Yeah, from John
McGurk.
From an essay he wrote. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess what kept the book together for me as well, for me, a very long period, writing it 4 years, was the fact that the initial inspiration was quite a clean thing. It's John is looking for his island in the west of Ireland. So if ever I was really struggling, I could just tell myself, he's just looking for his island. And I had. You know, so when you can tell a book in a line like that, it's a real help.
Yes.
And anyone who's listening who is trying to write a novel, it's probably something that gets said to you again and again and again. But if you can say the book in a line or two like that, it is a real help when you're having the bad days with it. If you can just go back then and go, okay, well, I can just work with that again, you know. But yeah, it's interesting. I think Beetlebone is much closer to the tone and the mode of the short stories than the previous novel, City of Bohan, is.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a really lovely thing to get it out the door to finish it and to have people enjoy it and say they liked it and stuff, because it was a long time
book,
on the desk.
I think.
Yeah, that's kind.
Very haunting book. And the reviewers found it haunting. They were haunted by it. I know somebody who said it was their earworm through the summer they read it. And that sort of sense of layering, I suppose. Not a sense of struggle. There's not a sense of struggle. There's a sense of lightness. But there's lots of space for the reader to enter it.
Yeah, I'm definitely haunted by it. It's really nice, actually, if you've been with a long, difficult project and you get through it intact, it gives you great confidence, you know, to go on to the next thing. Mm-hmm. You think, well, I got away with a John Lennon novel, you know, which is an unlikely thing to try.
Mm.
It was really nice to get it out the door, and I felt like I'd really expanded as a writer from the challenge of it.
And I think you developed in it something that's is there in your short fiction, which is a sense of characters haunted by the past. Your characters will carry memories with them.
Sure. You know, in one way it's similar to the novel City of Bohan, in that it's really all about people who can't step out from the shadow of their own pasts and their own kind of glorified youths and so forth. But it's funny as well, it's often musical songs and bits of music that I like are often the prompt to start something, and they kind of goad me into action, for want of a better word. And I think at the root of it is some kind of unsatisfied musical impulse in myself. I think if I was able to play the flute or sing, I wouldn't have to write stories at all. I'd be fine.
Well, I don't think we would be. I'm so glad you can't. I'm really glad you can't. Because it's extraordinary having that sort of sense of characters, and every character, even in the short stories, or especially in the short stories, have these pasts that they carry with them, and that totally overshadow the present at times.
Yeah, and I guess it tends to be the narrative of so much of our lives, really, doesn't it?
Mm.
And what's really interesting, I think, as you get older, is you feel the weight of the past accumulate all the time behind you, and you have much more of it that you're dealing with all the time. But it's how the past changes all the time, and you start to see your own past in very different ways. What seemed like maybe a dreadful period at one time in your life, you look back and think that was actually quite a very interesting, useful time or something. So the past, I always think, isn't stable.
No,
whereas it changes all the time.
Yeah, it's part of the imagination.
Yeah,
isn't
absolutely.
It?
Yeah,
and
but the past is a kind of an imaginative concept.
Yes.
In lots of ways.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I did want to ask you about the imagination, because some of your characters experience their imaginations as quite malevolent. There's a kind of a danger in their imagination. So, for example, I'm thinking of Sara in Dark Lies the Island.
Mm,
the kind of sensations that she has are quite traumatic. And Dr. Sott's alcoholic visions and the hallucinations of your narrators of Wifey Redux and Wistful England, which is a delicate
It's funny,
story,
actually, sometimes when
they're haunted by their own imaginations, and they trick them.
Yeah, it's funny, actually, sometimes when the stories are described in reviews and stuff, especially in American reviews, actually, they're talked about as being very dark and gothic, and it always kind of surprises me, because I don't feel like they are. And then I kind of look back into them and go, okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
The title story, actually, Dark Lies the Island, that was very difficult. It was on the desk for a long time. It's kind of one of the only stories I've ever written that doesn't have even a shred of humour in it, I suppose. There are no laughs, you know.
There are a few laughs.
Oh, maybe there are.
I think the digs at artisanal cheese, for example.
Okay.
And
there might be some kind of wry commentary.
And the
kind
of middle-class pretensions of the architect father.
Oh, actually, she's the father's kind of funny, actually, yeah.
And the mother with her.
Yeah. Yeah. But like...
And the breasts.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. No, I mean, it's about a young girl with a suicidal impulse. And what was really difficult was to finish the story. In the book, in the finished version, it has a vaguely hopeful finish where she kind of pulls back from the impulse. There were lots of drafts beforehand where she didn't pull back from the suicidal impulse. And it ended with blood on the floor kind of thing. And I just couldn't go with it, you know. It just felt too... when I was looking at it like that. And I still have mixed feelings about that story. I sometimes think of it and think maybe I kind of chickened out a little bit, but at the same time I'm kind of...
I don't think it's a total reprieve as a reader. I felt that was okay for that night, but perhaps the next day,
it's always going to be there again.
Because it's sort of the power of ritual against the darkness, but then the ritual becomes the darkness. Or the ritual becomes the thing that...
Yeah, it's a story I nearly gave up on a lot, but I was always very kind of happy with it on a kind of a sentence by sentence level. I think some of the writing in the story is some of the strongest that I've done. Like, short stories can be so easy to start, you know, and so exciting and thrilling to have a new one on the desk. But sometimes then tying them up at the end is very difficult. And actually, that impulse to even tie them up and to try be neat in some way at the finish can be very unhelpful to a writer, you know. I guess most of my own favourite stories by other writers would be stories that are quite open, really, at the end, and you're not sure what's happening. And sometimes, actually, readers ask me, what happens next, you know? Or where does it go afterwards? And I honestly have no idea what happens before or after, really. I just like it as this kind of... That kind of slice,
of time. You've talked about the kind of hallucinatory things that happen in John Lennon's life, and... that kind of power of the imagination to give visions. Do you see that as something that you as a writer in particular are harnessing? Do you see the imagination as something that can be dangerous or...
Yeah. I guess it's quite a nutty book, you know, Beetlebone. I always feel that where I write is kind of... At first glance it will seem to be a kind of reality or a kind of realism even, but that quite quickly... it will go to a place where the reader is aware, okay, this has been stretched greatly. Okay, we're not quite in Kansas, you know, anymore. and that it's tiptoeing always out towards the very edge of believability, mm-hmm. and the cusp of believability, and kind of vaguely visionary things start to happen. And I'm sure there are lots of hallucinations. I'm trying to think of specific instances around the stories where there are, but it's
Sarah has somebody grabbing her neck.
She does, yeah, and she's seeing kind of faces outside the house and in the dark and so forth. Yeah, it's very often with the what I'm trying to do, I suppose, with the reader is lower them directly down into someone's consciousness.
Yes.
Obviously at a time of difficulty or trouble, often.
And in Wistful England, your first person narrator as well.
Yeah.
Keeps seeing the girl he's lost.
I really have a strong feeling for that story, and it's not mentioned very much to me.
Mm.
But I really like it. Not much happens in it. There's not much in the way of event or plot or anything like that, but
it's a great sense of yearning, a great sense of loss in that story.
Yeah, and I'm happy with placing it, actually, because it's set in Leytonstone in East London in the mid-90s, where I did live in the mid-90s, and I think I kind of got something of the kind of the grimness of it at that time. Apparently gentrified since, to my disbelief, Leytonstone has been gentrified, but it's, I've never read it at an event or anything, but I came across it not long ago, a draft of it in the office at home, and I started reading through a page, that's one of my favourites in a strange way. It's funny, actually, as a story writer, one of the things that it does for you, and this is something that John Cheever wrote about in his introduction, lovely introduction to his collected stories.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at one of your stories, it transports you back very directly to that time in your life when you wrote it, and what you were up to, and what you were feeling, and what was wrong with you, and all those. It's a lovely kind of unexpected thing with writing. Actually, is that it works from memory, but it also actually kind of deepens your memory of in a very sensual kind of way of places you are and times you went through and all of that. And it's one of the really kind of nice things about it, you know.
I wanted to ask you as well about feeling, but feeling, you said, whatever it is you're most scared of surfacing in your work, you can be sure it's not far away. And you suggest that what you're afraid of is sentimentality?
Oh yeah, completely so. And that would have been very much the case, I'd say, when I was writing stories for the first time in my 20s and early 30s. So, you know, I would have had a lot of younger writers, was a terror of sentiment showing up or of too much feeling. Or too much emotion.
And are feeling and sentimentality the same thing?
Well, you see, there's that very difficult area, isn't there, between them when they kind of rub up against each other. And it's funny, sometimes when you're like at that stage as a kind of an emerging writer and you read back over your work and you come upon these moments where you recoil in horror from the page and you're immediately cut. But actually now I'm getting very interested in the bits that embarrass me when I read back over stories, because very often those are the good bits, and those are when you're getting at the kind of true stuff. And I think I used that line in Beetlebone, kind of just talking about the place in the book where I mention losing my mother very early, age 10, and it was the first time I'd written directly about that in my work, and it was very huge surprise to me that it would come in a novel about John Lennon, you know. But in a very natural way, it felt to me, because I was trying to create a portrait of an artist at a particular time in his life, and you just bring everything you can to that from your own life. And what had I in common with John Lennon? That was something he also had, where he lost a parent at a young age. But yeah, I think I actually stole the actual line, that quote, from somewhere. But I think it's very true that whatever you're afraid of, it's very close by, you know.
Yes, you
and you should be not afraid to kind of investigate it a bit.
Yeah. And I wondered, because there is some cruelty in your stories. You explore cruelty. There's the vicious assault on an autistic lad, Donny, in a cruelty.
In the story of cruelty. Yeah,
in the story of cruelty. And there's a savagery, real savagery, in The Girls and the Dogs.
Mm.
Where your narrator is trapped in a caravan and tortured.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's Ernestine and Kit, sort of seemingly harmless old ladies, who speak so sentimentally about the little children
they intend to abduct. Yeah, there's just been a short film made of Ernestine and Kit, and it's really good.
That's terrifying.
I know. I think, I often think, actually, that things like cruelty and violence, and this probably sounds completely daft, is that they're almost energies or forces that exist in the world, mm. naturally, and that people can decide to tune into them mm. or not, you yes. know, as humans. And in sometimes in the stories, the characters do. Ernestine and Kit is almost a comical take yeah. on that version, as in it's kind of like a little horror film,
it is.
I feel. It's a kind of a genre piece. It's like a little slasher movie, essentially, on the page. So it's kind of not meant to be taken, I guess, too seriously. Whereas A Cruelty, that story, mm. is kind of much darker in a way, even though mm. not very much happens, really. And there's a slight tussle. But it's a kind of a much more heartless story in that that character's life, Donnie, who's, I don't say specifically what's wrong with him, I think, but we can mm. see that he's somewhere
spectrally
kind
yeah.
of thing. But you just know that his kind of, his world has been destroyed, really, by yeah. this seemingly quite small incident. His kind of sense of safety and routine
yeah.
is kind of blown away. But it's funny, I very often write stories in tandem, two stories at the same time mm. will be going on the desk. And I was writing A Cruelty at the same time as I was writing the first book in the story, which is a very tender for me thing, it's about a bungled kiss
yeah.
called Across the Rooftops.
Yeah.
And I was literally going from one to the other oh. over a couple of weeks. And I think it was writing such a kind of almost sweet and
yes.
tender story that somehow gave me
yes.
the strength to go and do this other really,
yeah.
really dark piece, actually.
Because yeah, I was wondering if The Cruelty was in some way an attempt to exercise the sentimentality
yeah.
which you felt.
God, I have no idea, but very maybe.
In 2012, one of the stories in this collection, Dark Lies the Island, won the Sunday Times Short Story Award. And Hanif Qureshi, who was one of the judges, praised it as possessing a sensitivity that never transgresses into sentimentality. So your goal was achieved, and I was wondering if you wouldn't mind just reading the opening of the story.
I will, okay.
Thank you.
So from the start of Beer Trip to Clandudno. It was a pig of a day, as hot as we'd had, and we were down to our t-shirts taken off from Lime Street. This was a sight to behold. We were all of us biggish lads. It was Real Ale Club's July outing, a Saturday, and we'd had word of several good houses to be found in Clandudno. I was double jobbing for Ale Club that year. I was in charge of publications and outings both, which was controversial. Rill. We'll pass Rill, won't we? This was Mo. We'd have come over to Rill as kids, said Mo. Ferry and coach. I remember the roller coasters. Never pass Plestate and me, said Tom Neresford. Tom N, so-called. There were three Toms in Ale Club. He rubbed at his belly in a worried way. With sympathy for that. We all knew stomach trouble for a bugger. Down on its luck would be my guess, said Everett Bell. All these old North Wales resorts have suffered dreadfully, haven't they? Old mob's gone off to bloody Laos on packages. Bloody Cambodia, bucket and spade. Everett wasn't inclined to take the happy view of things. Billy Stroud, the ex-Marxist, had nothing to offer about Clandudno. Billy was involved with his timetables. 2 minutes and 50 seconds late taking off, he said, as the train skirted the Toxteth Estates. This thing hits Clandudno for 1:55 p.m. I'm an exotic dancer.
Thank you. And it's a really lovely, gentle story. It's a story that kind of depends on the difference between the humorous dialogue and the pathos in the subtext.
Yeah, it's about a subject, I suppose, that's weirdly unexplored in fiction as well, which is male friendship,
mm-hmm.
a kind of fraternity. It doesn't come up. Mm-hmm. Very much. I think male writers are afraid to talk about it too much. And again, actually, this story, it's no coincidence that some of my favourites have a very clear memory of a very inspired moment where the whole story presented itself. And what happened was I was living in Liverpool, where the Real Ale Club is from.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a lovely flat in the old kind of financial district of the town, but the heating was bad. And we used to had no option but to go to a pub called the Lion Tavern at night, and it used to be frequented by a local branch of Camra, the Real
mm-hmm.
Ale Society. And one night on the bar I saw the Real Ale Club's newsletter,
mm-hmm.
the Camra Club's
yes.
Newsletter, and I had reports of recent
beer outings.
And I just thought, what a gift,
mm-hmm.
because it's a perfect shape
mm-hmm.
for a short story, the beer club's outing, you know, to the seaside kind of thing. And I wrote it actually about 2 years after we had left Liverpool, and all the time, I lived there for 3 years. My girlfriend, now wife, was lecturing there at the time, and I complained about it a lot when I was there and whinged and grizzled. But as soon as I left the place, I was immediately very nostalgic for it. And I'm always kind of retrospectively happy. Like, because I'm never happy at the time. Yes. And I kind of wrote the story then as kind of a love letter to the place in a way. I do love Liverpool accents. And there is a way in for an Irish writer to a Liverpool accent, yes, as well. It seems like a very close,
yes,
first cousin.
You
really
talk about that in Beetlebound, don't,
yeah,
you?
Yeah. And definitely living in the city was something that gave me the confidence to try Beetlebone, mm-hmm, further down the road as well.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I have very little memory of the actual day-to-day writing of the story, only I know it was very quick, two or three days, and that it didn't seem to need much in terms of subsequent drafts, that it was kind of there. And you get that, I think, when from the off, you have a natural shape.
Yes.
And the outing.
Yes.
Give a very natural shape. They go to the seaside. They have their events. They come back that night on the train. And it's set on the hottest day of the summer,
mm-hmm,
which would be a matter of severe discomfort for the biggish chaps,
yes,
of the Real Ale Club. And actually, the day we were moving out of Liverpool was hysterically hot. It was late July. It was about 35 degrees. It was this kind of tropical weather. And I remember just loading up the car and getting ready to go for the ferry. We were moving to Dublin at that time, and the phrase Tropic of Lancashire came out of nowhere into my head, and I had that then waiting,
yes,
to use it for a couple,
yes,
of years, in the way that you save up stuff sometimes,
yeah,
as a writer.
Great. Well, I hope that this discussion of these wonderful stories has given our listeners the real impulse, if they haven't read them, to go and read them. I think their trip to Llandudno is available online, is it not?
I think it is,
yes,
somewhere, yeah. I think it is up there.
And we'll post the link on the Threshold Forum. So thank you very much for talking to us, Kevin. Thank you for all your insights into your work. And
it's been a pleasure, Jack. Thanks a lot.
And I look forward to reading the next.
Right. As the chainsaws crank up outside,
yes,
it's time to wrap
to go.
It up.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Jack. That was great.